In today's world, we are increasingly dependent on technology. Our business and personal lives rely on it, but as you've probably noticed, it's unreliable. They promise it'll get better, but it usually gets worse. Our computers are slow, so we end up squinting at smartphones and tablets. We live in constant fear that something's going to happen to our personal data, so we're scared into paying for fake protection that proves useless when disaster strikes. Update attacks, fake Wi-Fi, cloud control, and other industry scandals are designed to keep the money flowing. The jokers we pay to fix our stuff have no clue what they're doing, so they do a virus scan and then wipe out our precious photos. Intelligent, successful people feel intimidated by the chaos and think it's somehow their fault. If they only knew what the industry was doing to them, they'd get torches and pitchforks. If only we had someone to explain it all in plain English so we can start protecting ourselves. Oh wait, we do! It's the Computer Exorcist Podcast with your host, Mark Anthony Arena.
From the Wallace Memorial microphone in my home office, overlooking the can of worms in downtown Rochester, New York, this is the Computer Exorcist Podcast, coming to you again with yet another fascinating guest. My name is Mark Anthony Arena, and my guest today is Aaron Welty, who is a brilliant public speaker. He speaks about overcoming difficulties and just, oh, wait till you hear this guy. Wow. He and I met through Wallace of the Wallace Memorial Microphone. So we are here to attempt to do him some justice and say some great things with the microphone today. Aaron Welty, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. It's good to be here and that we finally get to do this because I know we've been talking about it for a while.
Yeah, so long. It's something that has needed to happen for so long. I'm going to read your bio and then I'm going to ask you some questions here and I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
All right.
So Aaron Welty was diagnosed with cerebral palsy as a newborn. He overcame those early years of low expectations to serve as the senior legislative assistant for Michigan's 11th Congressional District, wherein he focused on a variety of policy issues. He graduated from Cedarville University in 2006 with a degree in public administration. Prior to working on Capitol Hill, Aaron worked in marketing and media at the Heritage Foundation. Passionate about the ideas of individual purpose and destiny. That's why you don't hear about that anymore, do you? His unique story of faith, family, perseverance, and chasing dreams has been shared on NBC Nightly News, various radio programs, Roll Call, a nationally syndicated newspaper, and Facing Life Head On, a life issues-focused television program. You know, it's funny, I like how you said faith, family, and perseverance. My grandma would always say family, food, and faith. That's those columns, right? You need to have those columns. And I'd love to hear more about the life issues television program too. That, yeah, I'm all about facing issues head on. I love that. So tell us, yeah, how did you do all those things?
Well, I would say a lot of it has to do with mom and dad, right? Mm-hmm. I was raised in the Midwest in the suburbs of Detroit, and despite all of the things that I went through as a kid and a teenager, the interesting thing about kind of cerebral palsy in the medical community is they tend to treat it as more of a childhood condition, and you know, if you make it successfully make it to adulthood, it's kind of like, hey, you know, good luck, you know, out there in the big wide world. Mm-hmm. But you know, a lot of it had to do with the way mom and dad raised me. They wanted my childhood to be as kind of normal and mainstream as possible, right?
Oh, you know, brilliant. What's a mom and dad? I've heard of people being raised by a TV before, but what are these people you speak of? Do they just hand you money and put you in front of TikTok, or what do they do?
Well, no, they actually raise their kids, and they're engaged in their lives, right?
What?
I mean, when you look at it this way, the day I was born, right? One of the things to understand about what often happens with cerebral palsy diagnoses is that it's related to premature birth complications, right? Like, I was born at 30 weeks development. I was born 10 weeks early in the early 80s at a time when they didn't expect you to survive, to the point where the day I was born, and the hospital I was born in was actually a hospital where my grandmother worked as a nurse at the time.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, grandma was there with my mom, you know, the day I was born and stuff. And grandma was actually there as a patient that day. And so my grandpa went up to her, you know, went up to her room and said, "Hey, like, I know you're here as a patient, but I also know you work here. Your daughter's here and she's about to give birth to your, you know, first grandkid. If you want to get downstairs, you better do it now." And so it didn't matter to her that she was also a patient. She was like, "I'm going to be there." And she, you know, she made sure that she was there. And so in our family, part of the family lore surrounding my, you know, birth circumstances was that pretty much as soon as I was born, there was a group of doctors that kind of took me away from my parents for a while to another part of the hospital to decide what was going to happen to me.
To decide whether or not you should survive or what?
I mean, kind of, yes. I mean, they didn't expect me to. So, you know, my understanding is that the question was, you know, to what degree do we use resources to try to, you know, give this kid a shot when we're pretty sure that he's not going to make it?
So decide how much help they were going to give you.
Yes. And so what's interesting about this is that this is a story that my grandma, you know, told me, you know, 20, 30 years later, is that there was a nurse in the room who knew my grandmother, who was friends with my grandmother. They worked together. She knew the family. She knew I was the first grandkid. And she's the one who kind of stepped in with these doctors and stood in the gap for me and said, "Hey, you need to do everything you can for this kid, because, like, we know the family. Wow. Grandma works here, right?" And so these doctors, wow. Yeah,
she stood up for you when you
she did
stood up, stand up for yourself.
That's right. She did. You know, you think about Solomon in Proverbs 30 and Proverbs 31 and talking about how it's the duty of a king. It's the duty of those in power to speak up for those who cannot speak up for themselves. Whoa. That's what she was doing. Right. And so these doctors looked at me and all they saw was a premature problem. This nurse looked at me and she saw possibility and potential and knew she needed to stand in a gap. Wow. So, like, that was all like day one.
That was just the first day.
Yeah, that was day one, right? And so, you know, a lot of who I've become and how I've been able to walk through things and persevere through things is, you know, has to do with the fact that, you know, mom and dad raised me to persevere and to be as independent as I could possibly be. You know, I was fortunate to grow up in a mid-sized, you know, church in my hometown where four generations of my family attended that church at the same time when I was young, from my great grandparents all the way down to my brother and myself.
I'm similar, where I would go to a church, the church I grew up in, and my grandma eventually joined that church so that she could go to church with all of her grandkids, and mm-hmm. She's like, "I'm going, this is our church now."
Right. And so I grew up in an environment like that. I grew up in an environment where kind of because my mom's family was kind of a known entity in the church and one of the largest families in the church at the time, like my situation, the medical and mobility challenges I had and still have, it was a known thing at church, and that church, you know, kind of embraced me as, you know, one of their own. And it was a great space to grow up in. There's this story, actually, of when I was a kid. I was with one of my really good buddies growing up, and I think either his mom or my mom were driving to church for something, and we get there early, and they park in the handicap spot for one of the handicap spots in the parking lot of church. And my buddy, his name was Evan, kind of speaks up and says, "Mom, what are we doing parking in the handicap spot?" And she's like, "Well, because Aaron's here in the car." And Evan's like, "Aaron's not handicapped. What are you talking about?" Wow. Right? Like, that wasn't necessarily a forefront calculus for a lot of the church friends I grew up around and those kind of things. So,
you ever read the book Maniac McGee?
I recall reading it when I was younger, but I don't remember much about it.
I found it and reread it as an adult and just a couple years ago. And one of the things is the kids never saw each other as black kids and white kids and whatever, right? They just didn't. It's like, what do you mean? I'm just part of this group. And it kind of flies in the face of the identity politics, doesn't it? Where they just saw you as you're Aaron, and there's
Right.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I think you and I would agree that when it comes to identity, right, it would be very, very easy for me to root my identity in the challenges that I have. It'd be very easy for me to do that. It would, you know, certain sectors of culture would laud me for doing something like that.
I call it qualifying downward, where the more things that you have that you can claim as, the more claims that you have, the more benefits you get, right? And so people are actually motivated downward.
I've never heard that before, but that's interesting.
I invented the term, but yeah,
it's to describe
a behavior that's rampant around here, where young people strive to display as many disabilities as they can to get as much free money as they can.
That is fascinating.
And so now you've got, you know, perfectly able-bodied kids who could totally go out there and work, and they're just like, "Well, I'm this, I'm this, I'm this, so I get this much free money."
Yeah, I don't have that mindset. I just, you know, I wasn't raised that way. I don't think that way. And so, you know, I've had to make this choice where, I don't want to necessarily be, you know, pigeonholed kind of that way. I have a good friend. He and I have talked often for years, and we met on a trip to actually Northern Ireland and Oxford, where we were tracing the life of C.S. Lewis together probably 7-8 years ago now. But the thing he likes to say to kind of describe my situation is that the medical and mobility challenges I have with cerebral palsy, they're not everything, but they're not nothing. Mm-hmm. They're something, but they're not the overarching, overriding thing in life. And I've kind of made this decision that yes, those things are part of my life, but they're not necessarily like what I want to be known for. I would much rather be known for like being a superhero nerd and loving Star Wars and, you know, getting to, you know, travel the country and do public speaking and those sorts of things. And yes, the medical and mobility challenges are part of that. And they are an important part of that, but they are not everything. I mean, even, you may notice that even in talking about this, like, I don't even use the word disability. Mm-hmm. And the reason I don't use that term is because a disability is an inability to do something.
And you're doing everything. Right. I mean, right? You're not sitting home like all the people in my city who are just trying to get, you know, being a burden on society, really. You know, and years ago, I had a choice in 2011 where I'd just gotten laid off and I had a buddy and he said, go ahead, take the unemployment. He goes, it's yours. You're entitled to it. It's yours. And I said, yeah, but something in me just doesn't want to do that. I said, if I choose, and that was the moment that I chose to take my, at the time it was a side gig, and make it into a full-time business, which I do now. And I said, you know, God's going to pay me back someday. And he certainly did. But, and another quick thing, I mean, you know, light bulbs are going off in my head as you're talking, right? I had a buddy who had a heart attack at 25 and he survived.
Wow.
And I would just check on him, you know, throughout the next few weeks. Hey, how you feeling? How you doing? How you doing? And he goes, you know what, Mark? This happened. Okay. It's there. I'll acknowledge it happened. He said, but I refuse to live my life as that guy who had that heart attack.
Mm.
Right?
Yep. So
I'm not going to let it. And in your case, and we're going to get into this for sure, but in your case, you took this and you made it into something that actually gave you greater power. And I'll, in a tiny way, like I'm coming out with two books that talk about some horrible tragedies that I went through as an adult and how I took those lessons, and those lessons supercharged me, right? Mm. So this is, you took that, right? And you turned it into what you call, and I want to ask you about this, the heroics of weakness.
Right? Yes.
And that's your, I want to ask you about Capitol Hill first, but I want to ask you about heroics of weakness. Where do you want to start?
We can start wherever you like.
Tell me, how did you get into, and go ahead then, finish with your growing up and then how you got into Capitol Hill. Why don't we do that?
So kind of as an example of what we're talking about, where we make decisions around the kind of person we're going to be, right? And this decision I made around, you know, yes, this is part of my life, but it's not the whole of my life. Like, I am going to rule it. I'm not going to let it rule me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Wow.
And so 9 years ago, today, in 2015, I went on a trip with my dad and some friends to Israel. We went on a pilgrimage trip to Israel for 10 days and saw a bunch of...
I wanted to ask you about this because that's
You know, we saw a bunch of sites and spent, you know, some time in Jerusalem. And so part of this trip, we did a 3-mile hike in the wilderness of southern Israel. That was 9 years ago yesterday. You know, yesterday afternoon, 9 years ago. And I had to train physically for 6 months to be able to do this hike. I knew it was going to be hard. I knew it was going to be strenuous and difficult and challenging. And so I didn't realize we were going to do it our first full day in country.
Jet lagged and everything.
Right. Jet lagged and everything. You had like one night of sleep, and then, you know, here we are, it's after lunch, and our the pastor who was leading the trip that we were on says, hey, Welty, you remember when you said to me 6 months ago you wanted to go on this trip and we talked about the hike and how you were going to train for it? I said, yeah. He says, the hike is next. And I was like, what? Like, you didn't tell me the hike was like the first day. And so we get to the site and I realize that the terrain is difficult enough to where I'm not going to really be able to use my walker.
Uh-huh.
So I had to do a 3-mile hike in the wilderness of southern Israel without the walker.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so,
dude,
like,
I'd be winded after, like, honestly, I can't even run more than a mile. My lungs just, they're like, sorry, dude.
So we do this hike, and the way we ended up doing it was my dad was on one side of me, and like our pastor who was helping lead the trip was on the other side. And there's this picture somebody took of the three of us kind of arm in arm, you know, in the middle of nowhere. That's fantastic. And so we do this hike, and on this hike, I became good friends with one of our guides who was local in country, and we talked a lot about Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and superheroes and stuff. And we realized
that brings people together. Yeah.
Yeah. We realized we're both nerds. And so like, yeah, it was fantastic. And so we get done with this hike and we're on the bus on the way back to where we were staying. And my dad and the pastor come to me and says, "So, hey, Aaron, tomorrow morning, we're going to climb Masada. You think you could do that?"
Uh-huh.
Right? And I was like, wait a minute. I just did this really tough, strenuous 3-mile hike, you know, with everybody. And we're going to climb a mountain tomorrow?
Tomorrow. And we're going to climb a mountain tomorrow?
Right? And you think about, you know, Kirk and Spock at the beginning of Star Trek V, like Wallace and I used to reference this all the time. You know, why do you climb a mountain, Spock? Because it's there.
Because it's there. Wow.
Because it's there. You know, when they're camping in Yosemite at the beginning of Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Like, terrible Star Trek movie, but like awesome opening. Right.
I need to rewatch all of those. I should rewatch all of them with you so I get an explanation.
Yeah, that actually would be really fun if we did that.
Remind me.
So we get there, and I realize like there are two ways up Masada, right? The top of this is, you know, the ruins of an old, you know, Jewish fortress, and like one of like Herod the Great's palaces and stuff is up there, and this mountain fortress space was the inspiration for the city of Jeddah in Rogue One, a Star Wars story.
No.
So there's that connection too.
Wait, Rogue One, that was what, 3.5? They call it like
it. Yeah.
I loved that movie.
Yeah. That's 3.5.
It was such a good movie. Wow.
It's fantastic.
And the self-sacrifice of that guy and
Well, of everybody, really.
Yeah, wow.
So we get to Masada and I realize, okay, Walker's not gonna work, obviously, because you're climbing a mountain. And there's this set of crazy stairs that you have to climb your way up to get to the top. And so we get to the stairs, and I realize some of these stairs, I mean, they're old, like, you know, really, really old.
Oh, zillions of years old, yeah.
You know, some of these stairs are so big that I can't get my legs up over them.
Uh-huh.
So there's a railing on the left side of the set of stairs. And okay. So I grabbed the railing, and then we put somebody on the other side of me, and I push off the railing and the other person's shoulder, and I literally Spider-Man swing my lower body all the way up this set of stairs up the mountain.
Using the Spider-Man swing.
Right, using the Spider-Man swing. And
that. I mean, usually you talk in figurative terms about superheroes, but you are physically turning. Nice.
I am. I'm physically doing the thing, and and one of our guides, who I'd become, you know, friends with the day before on the hike, you know, we're talking about superheroes and all this stuff. While we were doing this hike, there was a group of IDF soldiers who were doing a wilderness exercise at Masada that apparently everybody goes through.
Yeah.
And so they're also making the climb and all of their kit and all of their military kit and stuff. And so they get to the top and there's this ceremony that happens where, you know, they get awarded for, you know, the end of this training exercise and all that. And so our guide gets to the top and starts talking to these IDF soldiers that are finishing up this exercise. And they're like, "So there's this guy down there, right, who's got all these medical challenges, who's doing this hike, you know, just like you guys are. And it's so much harder for him. And like, he's not going to get some big reward at the end like you guys are getting.
Wow, you know, so these, right, they're using this as a training exercise for these IDF guys, and you're just rolling with it. And I'm
just rolling with it. You know, I'm climbing the mountain because it's there, right? Like in Star Trek V. And so our guide goes to these IDF soldiers and basically says, yeah, you guys think you're all that for doing this, but this guy down there, he's more badass than you are.
Yes, right? Right?
So, yeah, so that was right. 9 years ago today.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, like...
And it really is, right? It's right. It's easy to do something, but it's a lot harder. You're more BA if you could do it with 10 times. You know, it's kind of like when you... plenty of examples, right? But it's like, I could do it with one hand tied behind my back, or like, I could do it despite all this. And wow. Huh. What's interesting, and again, back to the... So I do, and I might have told you about them before, and I always give them plugs on my show, and I've had them on when I was on local radio. I interviewed them several times, and there's a local... a group, a team of pastors called Bethel Express. And in the worst city in the universe, we have the worst crime, the worst graduation rates, the worst jail rates, and all that. But they show up, and the kids have to be willing to show up, of course. But they say, we'll give you a quiet, warm place to study. We'll give you tutoring. We'll give you food. We'll give you encouragement. And we'll give you the gospel. And surprise, surprise, they have 100% success rate, 100% graduation rate, 100% college, 100% everything, right? And part of the core of what they tell these kids, their secret sauce, right? The thing that they're telling these kids, I mean, think about it, right? If what you're doing doesn't work, try the opposite, right? That's when I went through the horrible things I did, and I'm writing this in my books, is, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't work? Hey, try the opposite. Maybe that'll work. Just like when you're doing a math formula, right? If 6 doesn't work, try -6 or vice versa, right? Do the opposite. So they tell the kids the opposite of what society tells them. They say, we do not go to jail. We become taxpayers. We are not weak. We are strong. You know, we don't take, we give. We're not burdens on society. We use our talents to give to society. Right? And it's the exact opposite of what they're told of, oh, yeah, you're never going to amount to anything. I remember going to sociology class in college, and the guy said, well, if you're black, you're never going to amount to anything, and you should just give up now. And I said, what? So they tell these kids the opposite, and what they say, we're not minorities, we're God's priorities. And again, it's the we give. And when you go from the poor me, the self-pity, to the we give, and it makes you realize, it doesn't create something, it makes you point out the thing that's been there all along, which is your innate value, and your talents, and your ability to give, and your calling to give. How's that for an explanation? And all of a sudden, when something is asked of you, that's when you show up and you shine. And that is why these kids do so well afterward.
Well, I think if you raise the bar, right? Mm-hmm. If you raise your level of expectation,
if something is expected of you, absolutely. Right.
If the expectation is raised, if the bar is raised, then you will do what you can to rise and meet the expectation, to rise and meet the challenge.
Yeah, and I've had when there was no one else around me who could do the job that I do, it's I had to step up, and I had to work long hours, and I had to figure it out myself. Yeah.
A few years ago, I came across a video on, I think on Instagram, of a young man in probably his like mid to late teens, maybe early 20s. And it was a video of him like physically training in a gym.
Okay.
And, you know, that shouldn't surprise anybody, except what was really interesting about this guy is that he has cerebral palsy like me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been regularly physically training for over a decade. Obviously, you know, I've gone on these trips, right? And I can't just go on them. I have to prepare for them and those sorts of things. And, you know, I have to try to stay in some semblance of shape to travel the country and speak to, you know, camps and conferences and colleges and that kind of thing. And
I'm going to go yell at all my clients. I have a lot of elderly clients, and I keep telling them, go travel the world. Oh, well, no, I'm too old. Go travel the world. Go. And they, well, I'm too old. And this guy's doing it.
Right. And what's interesting to me about this video isn't the video itself. It's the responses from people, like all of this, you know, encouraging, positive, like, oh my gosh, this is amazing, you're an inspiration kind of responses that I saw to this video of this young man with cerebral palsy physically training. Mm-hmm. And I started to think about this, and I was like, why is this happening this way? And I think the reason that this was happening this way is because the expectation mm-hmm. was so low, mm-hmm. right? The expectation was, wow, like this guy's doing this thing. And in so many, the minds of so many others, the expectation is because of the medical and mobility challenges that he has, he shouldn't be able to do this. He shouldn't have the capacity to be able to do this. And yet he's doing this thing. And I spent a long time sort of just kind of ruminating on this video and trying to figure out kind of what was going on, you know, behind the scenes in terms of the way people were responding to it and interpreting it. And what I realized is that our capacity for inspiration and wonder is tied to our level of expectation.
Whoa, I gotta write that down. That's okay. Good.
Our capacity for inspiration and wonder is tied to our level of expectation. And here's what I mean. That the lower the level of expectation you have, the easier it is to be inspired. The higher level of expectation you have, it's a little bit harder because you expect more from yourself. You expect more from the world around you. For example,
mm-hmm. Well, right, like they tell them, oh, you're never going to amount to anything. You know, in our city school district here, they just churn people out and they pass them because they just say they're never going to do anything anyways. We'll just pass them to get them out of here.
And so if you know, somebody in that situation, you know, then, you know, goes on to do some big, great thing, mm-hmm. you know, out of Rochester, I'm sure there are a lot of people who kind of respond, you know, much like people did about, you know, about Jesus being from Nazareth, this idea of Nazareth. Can anything good come from there? Like, can anything good actually come out of, you know, Rochester?
You ready for this, Aaron? That's one of their slogans. I have a bookmark from them and it says, can anything good come out of the hood? Come and see. Yeah. You nailed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. There we go. So if the bar is so low, if the bar of expectation is so low, as it often is with, you know, people that have the kind of challenges that I have, it's so easy to see individuals like that as an inspiration because we live in a culture that, you know, is willing to laud somebody for tripping over the bar.
Uh-huh. Or doesn't have any expectation at all for them, just expects
right.
them to do. And
right.
And again, I mean, it's unfortunately the way the I call it anti-motivation, right? The way my city is structured and the areas around it, it's we're going to take people of every level of everything and motivate them downward, right? Motivate them to qualify for benefits. So it's you got people all over the place, right? And they're all pointing, they're encouraging them to point themselves downward. Does that make sense?
Well, I think of you were saying, you know, earlier about, you know, teach them the opposite, right?
Yeah.
I think of the, you know, the comment that Lewis makes in the Narnia books through Aslan, the idea of you know, further up and further in, onward and upward, right? Not mm-hmm. not downward, but onward and upward. And a way to illustrate this is when I was talking earlier about that first day of life, right? The stories surrounding that first day of life for me. A couple of interesting things kind of occurred in the aftermath, where a few years later, yeah, this is another story from like my mom and my grandmother and stuff. A few years later, I ran into some of those same doctors as a young kid.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, wait a minute. Like, this is that kid? I was maybe 3, 4, or 5, you know, and I spent most of my early years in and out of the hospital. But so you had these doctors kind of amazed that I had made it that far. But what's really interesting to me, and I found this out maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I was home for a weekend. Our whole family was getting together to celebrate my grandmother and spend some time with her. And so there's all these people at my parents' house in Michigan. And I happened to stumble across a calendar somewhere in the house that I'd never seen before. And it was a calendar that my mom and dad kept of my first year of life. And on this calendar were a lot of different things, but there were some medical appointments. Mm-hmm. And so I grabbed this, I was looking through it, and I grabbed this calendar and I went to my mom and my grandma and I said, Mom, what is this calendar? And they explained to me what it was, and they were tracking certain things. And I saw a name on this calendar, a Dr. K. And I said, Mom, who's this doctor? Who's this Dr. K? And she proceeds to explain to me, he's one of the first doctors that you ever had. And he did not, you know, treat you or, you know, me and your dad all that well concerning you. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said something, you know, something would happen to you. Like you would stop breathing and you would start turning blue and we would kind of rush you to the doctor and stuff. And they would see you and, you know, part of kind of the doctor's response would be, well, you know, Mrs. Welty, like these are the kind of things that happen when you have a, you know, young child like your son, basically saying like, okay, your son has all of these different diagnoses and cerebral palsy and stuff. And, you know, he's fighting for his life. Like the kind of the undercurrent, the way I interpreted the undercurrent was if he wasn't here, you wouldn't be having these challenges. Like, cause these are the kinds of things that happen. Right. And mm-hmm. so my mom kind of explained, you know, that he wasn't that great of a doctor. And eventually like they found another doctor who became my pediatrician, and he was my pediatrician until I was like 20 years old. I mean, like he kind of became a family friend and stuff. And so there's this doctor. And so I'd never heard the story of this doctor before. And so I actually went and started Googling this guy and looking him up. And what I found was that he ended up, you know, kind of at the end of his life, at the end of his career, he was a big wig in the U of M like health system in Michigan. But he died when I was in college in the early 2000s. He died at the age of 74. Mm-hmm. And so I remember that night as I'm reading about this guy, this is probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was in my mid-30s. I remember saying, God, I would love to live to 75 just to make it longer than this doctor who had who had exceedingly low expectations for me.
Right. And if you live longer than him, sure. Wow.
Right?
Just to prove to him, so to speak, that, hey, you know what?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm totally good here.
You know, and the fact that one of the things that I think is interesting about some of this stuff is that the doctors knew what they thought they knew what they knew.
Right.
Truth is, they didn't know everything.
Right. And if you, right? I mean, it's obviously great you know, that we have the medical science and it's, that's fine, but to put your faith in it and to worship it as an absolute, right? And they're proven wrong constantly, right? If you worship science as your religion, but then, oh, wait a minute, they're constantly proven wrong, and here's this guy who defies everything that, that they said was going to happen and so on. That's really something. That's really, and to go back, I want real quick to go back to the expectations, right? One good thing that my parents did for me was when I was in college, I came home one day and I said, I want an allowance. And they said, we got you this far, kid. Now it's, you know, you got to figure this out. And I steamed off and stormed off. But then I started selling junk on eBay. And it was really rough for like 10 years. I just made barely anything selling junk on eBay. And I had no idea what to do with my life for a couple of years after college. But that forced me to figure things out for myself. And I do everything for myself. And my whole goal in life was to not have to go back to live with my parents after I graduated. Mm-hmm. And it really did force me to do a lot of things for myself. And so that was cool. I'm actually grateful for that in the long run. And it got me, I mean, even specifically the job of selling junk on eBay connected me with people around here, and that eventually got me jobs and so on. So it's that positive motivation of, hey, there's a need here. And guess right. what, folks? Despite what society tells you, we as humans respond to a need, and we figure out, it's kind of like there's something above us. We figure out how to reach high enough to grab toward that. We are motivated by that need, right? Necessity is the mother of invention, let's say.
I mean, you know, there were folks, you know, back in high school that when I talked about, even back then, wanting to, you know, come to DC and get involved in politics and stuff, you know, there were plenty of people who didn't think I would actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really realize this until years later. You know, I'd been out here in DC for a couple of years, and I was working on Capitol Hill at that point. And I came back to Southeast Michigan, actually back to the church I grew up in, for a wedding. Mm-hmm. One of my mom's really good friends, this really good friend of my mom, her niece was getting married to a guy that I actually went to elementary school with, and I hadn't seen in many, many years. We went to elementary school together and then part of high school together. And I'm at this wedding, and after the ceremony's over, I get kind of cornered in the lobby of the church, or, you know, back then they would call it the narthex, right? Of the church. And these two guys that I went to high school with that I hadn't seen since high school, they kind of cornered me and they said, Welty, like, where you been? Like, nobody's seen you since high school. I said, well, of course not. You know, I went to college in Ohio, and I graduated college, and, you know, now I live in DC and I work in, you know, in politics on Capitol Hill. And they both kind of looked at me like, wait a minute, didn't you talk about doing that back in high school when we all knew each other? I said, yes, sir, I did. And they just looked at me like, and you actually went and you're doing the thing that you said you were going to do?
You pulled it off and you're doing this instead of hanging out here?
And I said, yeah, I am. And they were just, I blew their minds, and I like, it blew my mind that I blew their minds by actually doing what I said I was going to do. Right.
And, it blew my mind that I blew their mind. And then over here in this city too, like, anyone who has any motivation immediately escapes. So there's pretty much nobody between the age of 12 and 50 in my city.
Wow.
They immediately escape, and then they all become immediate. I had a cousin who didn't know what to do with her life, blah, blah, blah. She was a bartender here. She gets in the car, and as soon as she hits the non-Rochester border, the sun comes out, and somebody calls her and offers her this great job down in New York City, and that was the end of it.
Oh, man. No, and so, you know, I came to D.C. after college, and that's where I met Wallace.
Wow. Well, that's cool. Right? And that's how you guys met in DC. Yeah. We're going to do a break here. This was the first episode with Aaron Welty, just introducing him and all of his stories, his crazy stories. We will be back for the next part. Stay tuned for the next episode. How can people go to your website?
So the best way to find me is I have a website. It's Aaron R. Welty, AaronRWelty, WELTY.com. And it's essentially my speaking website where you can find a demo video so you can see the kind of speaking that I do. You can engage a little bit with some of the speaking that I've done. You can engage a little bit with some of the articles that I've written kind of based on and around and that have inspired some of the speaking I do. There's an article on the heroics of weakness. There's an article on superheroes as modern mythology and why that's important. And you can, you know, easily connect with me if there's interest in having me come speak to your audience. And I know we'll get into more of that in a future episode.
TheComputerExorcist.com is how to find me and buy my book for everyone you know. It's called How to Protect Yourself from Your Computer and explains the tech industry in plain English. We will be back and talk to you next week for the rest of the episode. Thanks so much. It's all right now. Make it on my own. Give you an inch, and then they take a mile, stab you in the back, and look at you in your face with a smile.